The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk
with Matter Private Network. During current restrictions, don't ignore your health concerns. Our expert team is ready to help.
Now, on the horizon, there is, I suppose, some good economic news. The economy will grow by 4.5% this year, according to the Stability Programme update that was published this week. And there are further predictions that the domestic economy will come back strongly by 7.4% in 2022. Now, that's all dependent on a successful vaccination programme and the lifting of pandemic restrictions. Economist Jim Power has authored a new report on the pandemic and its outlook, and he joins me now. Jim, good morning.
Good morning, Pat.
Now, first of all, can I get your reaction to the KBC pullout of Ireland and the takeover of its performing business by Bank of Ireland?
I think it's another dreadful day for the Irish banking public. We've seen Ulster Bank announce it's leaving the market. We now have KBC about to leave the market. We have Bank of Ireland closing a lot of its branches. So for the banking public, this is just another nail in the coffin of customer service and also of competition within the banking sector. I mean, KBC have about 13% of the mortgage market. So they're a significant player and they certainly were aggressive. They certainly provided a lot of competition. So you remove that from the equation and you're going to get an even more concentrated banking sector with even less competition. And if I was looking at statistics, actually, in February, the average new mortgage rate in Ireland was 2.79%. The euro area equivalent was 1.27%. So even with the level of competition that we've had, Irish mortgage rates were well above the European average.
Okay,
and
but,
this
but here,
obviously
here's
is
the question. Jim, why would they pull out if they were getting 2.7% here and only 1.2% in Europe? Why would they pull out?
Obviously decisions are being taken by the foreign head offices of banks that operate here that it's no longer a good banking market in which to operate. That is, of course, a legacy of the crash after 2007-2008. They lost a lot of money and I think are basically, you know, not very committed now to investing in countries where they lost so much money in the past. So, quite frankly, international lenders are totally disinterested in Ireland, particularly for SME and for mortgage lenders at this juncture.
And, is it down to this, and I put it to the minister, but he's not for turning, that it's so difficult to get effective collateral for the money you're lending that even 2.79% doesn't compensate you for the risks you're taking, that you'll never see your money again?
Yeah, that's exactly the case. That is definitely one of the issues that is impacting on the commitment of foreign banks to Ireland. It's not a great environment in which to lend money. And, also, of course, there is the issue about the capital required in the Irish banking system is higher than in other countries at the moment. And that's another expense for banks. So quite frankly, the Irish banking market has become a lot less attractive for international players, and indeed domestic players have a limited commitment to, in my view. So the net result of all of that is that unless something serious is done to address this situation, the Irish banking public, or the potential banking public, which is even a bigger problem, will find it more and more difficult to get decent banking services and decent customer service. So whatever way you try and paint this, it is another very, very negative day on the Irish banking landscape.
Yeah.
And ultimately, it is the less bankable consumers who will be the big losers in all of this.
Yeah. Two things. I mean, first of all, were you surprised that the minister, as a shareholder in the Bank of Ireland, now ordinary shareholders wouldn't be consulted about management decisions, but the minister, a significant shareholder of Bank of Ireland, were you surprised at what he said, that he found out about it last night at 9 o'clock when the two chief executives rang him?
Not particularly. I mean, as a shareholder, I any other significant shareholder in the bank wouldn't have been informed either. So I suppose the Department of Finance, the Minister for Finance, is an ordinary shareholder in the banks. So no, that doesn't surprise me, to be perfectly honest. But you would kind of hope that in the normal course of events that the Department of Finance or the Minister of Finance specifically would be kept up to date by the financial institutions in the jurisdiction as to what they're doing and what they're planning. But I guess given the propensity of the Irish political system to leak absolutely everything, the banks would withhold that information to the last possible moment.
And it's not likely that the minister will do anything, because we're living in an era of populist politics. And if the minister tried to tighten up the rules on collateral for mortgage lending and so on, and that if you didn't, if you defaulted, you know, 6 months you get, and that's it, off you go. If he tried to tighten up, sure, he'd be crucified by probably from within his own party as well as from across the opposition benches. Moving on to the report that you've authored, Jim, which looks at the government's policy activity during the pandemic and what remains then in the economy and the and society in general thereafter. First of all, the provenance of the report, who commissioned you to do it?
The report was commissioned by COVID Recovery Ireland, which is a group that was set up some months back to look at alternative ways for the Irish economy, the Irish society and the Irish health service to rebuild and get their way out of this, you know, the crisis we've been living with since March 2020.
Who are the partners in that? I mean, are there political parties involved in it? Are there commercial interests? You know, who are the people who
There are some individuals with commercial interests, and there's a lot of people from the medical community who basically disagree with the stance that has been taken by the Irish government and the health authorities here since March 2020. I guess the reason why I agreed to do the report is because, and the reason why I was asked to do the report is because I have argued many of these things since last March, and everything I've put into this report, I 100% believe in. There are issues that were pointed in my direction that I ignored because I didn't agree with. So everything here, you know, I passionately believe in it.
Let's look at some of the things that you've been saying and the consequences. First of all, you're critical of NPHET, set up as a short-term response to something but ended up as something more long-term. Explain.
Yeah, well, NPHET was set up as an emergency response unit to a crisis that started to evolve in March 2020. I believe there were serious faults in the original mandate and the original membership of NPHET. I mean, NPHET was given one objective, and that is to make sure that the virus is kept under control, that the pressure is kept off our hospital system and the ICU units particularly. It was given a very one-dimensional mandate. It was given no mandate to consider broader issues such as the economy, the public finances, the impact on society, the impact on other aspects of the health sector. And also, if you look at the membership of NPHET, it was very much, there's nobody in there with a remote qualification in business, in the economy.
But in fairness, Jim, NPHET, it didn't stick its nose in those areas. It just said, this is the public health advice. This is what you should do. We think you should lock down. We think you should have mandatory quarantining coming in. And then it was over to the government to make decisions based on the public health advice. And they also would have economic input. So,
yes, Pat, I wouldn't be critical of NPHET in the sense that NPHET is delivering on the mandate, or it's trying to deliver on the mandate that it was given. Okay. Where the real fault lies is with government. The manner in which it accepted the advice given by NPHET, and the manner in which it implemented it. And the government, and so NPHET did what it was set out to do, okay? So you can't criticise them on the basis of that. But I do believe that from a government perspective, you know, implementing the policies recommended by NPHET, or otherwise, that it took no account, there was no attempt made at a cost-benefit analysis. you know, the benefit of the approach that has been pursued, which has effectively been rolling lockdown since March 2020, and the Oxford Stringency Index that looks at the various restrictions applying in different countries across the world shows that over the last 12 months, Ireland on average has been subject to the most stringent lockdown and restrictions in the developed world. So, you know, that is a fact. There was no attempt made to look at the costs of these policies, you know, the impact on the economy, the impact on the public finances, the impact on society, mental health, the impact on, you know, future health, sorry, existing health issues here and future health issues. So, for example,
Jim, you've outlined that, you know, 2,000 cancers went undetected in 2020, 626,895 people waiting for outpatient appointments, 12.2% higher. But did you look at ways in which the government might have done things differently? You described the policy of rolling lockdowns as a scorched earth policy. What might they have done different? What do they not do?
Well, I don't believe there was any proper risk assessment done. Okay, well, sorry, first thing, as I've just been saying, there was no cost-benefit analysis. If you sit down with a balance sheet, you look at the costs of the policies that are being implemented and you look at the benefits, okay? Second thing is risk assessment. If we accept there is no risk-free activity you can engage in, particularly in the current environment, every time you go outside the door, you are exposing yourself to some risk. But you've got to try and assess different risks. You know, for example, equating being in a packed pub with being on the side of a mountain, to me, does not make sense. And yet, I have been prevented from going up the Dublin and Wicklow mountains for, you know, since the end of December last. So it's stuff like that. It's the failure to look at the risks associated with different activities. And I was particularly infuriated, I have to say, a couple of weeks back when data was published by the HSPC showing that outdoor activities accounted for just 0.1% of cases. And yet the authorities here came out and basically dissed those statistics, said they weren't really reliable. So it's quite clear that when the statistics that are published suit the agenda that's being pursued, the statistics are great. But the moment the statistics don't agree with the agenda that's being pursued, they are flawed. I think there has been a huge communications problem. I mean, and anecdotally, it's pretty obvious. You know, the people of Ireland are totally exasperated at the moment. We've been getting all of this mixed messaging from different politicians within government, from different health officials across the health spectre. The communication exercise has been absolutely dispiriting. And if you think about the reality, and this, I suppose, is the kernel of what gets to me, it's the impact this has had on the thousands of small businesses around the country.
Okay.
Because it's small businesses.
Indeed, and people will suffer from mental health difficulties and they go broke and they are reduced to penury and all of that. But some of the texts coming in all saying similar things. What price do we put on the 5,000 people who've died? That's from Tom. How do you do a cost-benefit analysis for deaths? Any politician explaining why having more deaths is good for the economy would be himself or herself be a dead duck? That's from John in Limerick. Did Jim Power seriously say the cost-benefit analysis of the lockdown? Thank God for NEFA. The economy was opened up at Christmas and look what happened. The economy will recover quicker than we think, but the lives who are lost are now gone forever. That's from Sinead. So people are saying it's not all about the economy. We'll get over that.
Pat, I didn't say it was all about the economy, okay? I said a cost-benefit analysis, and on the benefit side, I looked at the benefits of what NEFA was doing, and the benefit was trying to save lives, okay? So I didn't for one moment try to downplay the tragedy of COVID-19, the lives that have been lost. But I tried to look as well at the costs involved in these policies. Were they the correct policies? Because what basically COVID has shown up here, and people have suffered, lives have been lost, future lives will be lost over the coming years because of this, of basically a failure of our health system to put systems in place to deal with this. I mean, the total failure, for example, to address rapid antigen testing. Not perfect, but it certainly reduces the risk of infection. Okay, if you look at the way in which track, trace and isolate has been implemented in this country over the last 12 months, it has been a total shambles. So, you know,
Jim, very critical of the government not doing things that just turned out to be a bit too much trouble. You know, quarantining when it was appropriate. Yes. Now, you know, they do it too late. But I want to read you something which I got from Public Health England, the National Health Service Test and Trace. And this is what they've told us. 26 million rapid lateral flow tests were conducted between the 8th of March and the 4th of April, almost a month. And 82% are regarded as being accurate. They discovered 30,904 positive tests, and 80%, four-fifths of them, took place in educational settings where the kids tested themselves. So as a result of that, they got almost 100% negative tests, but the few they found resulted in being able to keep kids home from school and stop the infections growing. This is from the NHS. We currently are still doing pilots. I mean, it's mad stuff.
It is mad stuff, absolutely. Why we haven't taken on board this sort of science just defies me. I mean, I am not setting myself up here, Pat, as a health expert. Okay, I know virtually nothing about health, but I do know that the policies that have been pursued, you know, will have long-lasting effects on our economy, our society and our health. Because, for example, if you look at the deficit that has been run up here this year, last year, the addition to our national debt, that is going to have repercussions for spending in areas like health and education for decades to come. So, you know, in 5 years' time, people will be complaining about aspects of our health sector, but quite simply, the money will not be available to invest in the health sector because of policies that have been pursued and mistakes that have been made over the last 12 months. I am not arguing for one moment that there are any right or wrong answers here. It is an incredibly difficult situation, and every country in the world is struggling with it. But I do think it is essential. It's probably too late, actually, at this stage because, you know, a lot of the damage has been done. But I would like to have seen a much more holistic approach adopted by policymakers here. Addressing COVID-19 was one issue, but there are many other issues in our economy and our society and the health of the nation that should have been taken into consideration as well.
Right, Jim, we have to leave it there. Economist Jim Power, who's authored this report, and we'll tell you in a few moments where to find it if you want to read it. But Jim, thank you very much for joining us.